It's time now for Ask the Pharmacist, and Elizabeth Roddick joins us from New Life Pharmacy. Hello.
Hello, Simon.
And we have got quite a lot to get through today. And we've just had Dementia Awareness Week in England and Wales and Ireland, and also in Scotland last week. How common is dementia?
If you look at the Alzheimer's Society reports, there are about 800,000 people in the UK with dementia.
Do we know what it actually is?
Well, we call it a syndrome, and as such, it's a group of symptoms. Most people think of dementia as memory loss, but it involves other aspects such as mental agility, language problems, the speed at which you think, understanding of what's being said, and an alteration in judgment.
So are there certain behaviours then that can be seen or demonstrated with someone who's got dementia? Things to look out for?
Yes, the common ones are, for example, repeating a question over and over again, like, what time is it? Some people pace up and down. They may become suspicious of you, and some of the more distressing features are when they become agitated. They could become aggressive and start shouting. I was doing something called a polypharmacy review in a local residential home for dementia, and what I was doing was looking at the medicines the residents were taking and working with the GPs to sometimes reduce the number of medication that someone was on and maybe alter doses because of a change in circumstances with a patient. For example, because an elderly person had lost weight and become more frail, then the dose of medicine they were on was now too high, or because living in their own home had resulted in a great deal of stress and maybe not eating properly, then when they were cared for in the residential home, some of the medicines, in fact, could be withdrawn. While I was there, I was often asked questions such as from the residents, have you seen my mother, bearing in mind they were all in their 70s and beyond. And I saw staff trying to cajole them into eating so as to keep them strong and well. I mean, it was a delightful home. Residents were well looked after, but the staff were sometimes working under very difficult circumstances. Staff need to have a great deal of patience, and also they're very well trained to deal with someone with dementia.
If you're living with someone with dementia, now my father and my mother had it at the end of their lives, are there ways that can help you cope with this?
I think the first thing is to realise that if the person is becoming agitated or aggressive, it's really their attempt to communicate, almost venting their frustrations. In many cases, the carer will have to initiate the conversation, and basic mechanisms to put in place with communication are speaking slowly, looking directly at the person when speaking, maybe waiting for them to try and process what you've said to them. So not coming in too quickly with an answer or another question. I mean, patience is definitely essential.
No, my own father had problems towards the end in vocalising. He couldn't find the word, so he would use other words to describe the word that he was looking for. I know there's a name for that. I can't remember what it is now. But my mum's was totally different, and you find that it's so individual for people, isn't it? There's so many different types. One of the things, though, that can be an issue is socialising, isn't it?
Yes, they can. Obviously, with socialising, they can become depressed and uninterested in socialising. In fact, might find it just too much for them. One of the big problems is they can start to lose the ability to remain independent, and they have difficulty in making everyday decisions. I mean, it's, you know, you have to think about that.
Yeah, and it's sad to watch, isn't it? And yet, yeah. And I know with my own dad at the times when we look back now and you see there were signs there well before it was diagnosed. And I don't know, sometimes I reproach myself sometimes, because I was always, my dad used to say I was so patient. But there was times where my dad was like a different person at times, and we're trying to do things, I would get so frustrated, you know. Yeah. Then you feel, and then I still look back and I feel sad about that, you know, for that. And being patient is really important. Is it important to get an early diagnosis?
Yes, it is, because getting the right treatment and support early on will help the person to live as full a life as they can, and that's what you want. Your GP, of course, should be the first port of call. It may be that you don't have dementia, but it's because of stress, depression, side effects of medicine, in fact, or another health problem which has resulted in forgetfulness or other symptoms. So it's not necessarily dementia. And so it's important to get a proper diagnosis rather than worrying needlessly. And being forgetful, of course, doesn't mean you have dementia. On the other hand, some of the medication that's available now needs to be started early, and that's the importance of getting an early diagnosis. So have a checkup if you're worried, or if you're worried about someone you're caring for. Now, emerging research suggests that education and learning another language, that's coming out as something that perhaps could reduce the risk of dementia. It's interesting. But also remember, there's a lot of support now for the carers of people perhaps at the early stages of dementia or even further on. So please find out about that as well. Get some help.
I heard an interesting part in some research the week before, where they had done some research and found that although there's problems sometimes with someone with dementia getting out and about, sometimes take them to a park or somewhere where there's nature, where they don't need to know what kind of tree it is, it's just a tree. Yeah. It's just grass. And there was one couple where I can't remember which one, was the man would go and visit his wife in the home, but then they actually started it where they would take her to the park and he would meet her in the park. And it was like getting his wife back as opposed to visiting a patient.
Different environment. Mm. That's very important, Simon, yeah.
Now, we'll move on to some headlines that you may have seen. And headline is, chemicals in everyday items like cosmetics are linked to cancer. That could be worrying.
Research was carried out by British and Swiss researchers. They received grants from the Medical Research Council. It was laboratory research, mainly looking at chemicals such as formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, these are in the environment anyway, in fossil fuels and in products that we use in our skin, for example, cosmetics, and that was what the headline was about. The researchers wanted to see if the chemicals could affect our DNA and therefore cause cancer. The BRCA2 gene produces a protein. Now, this protein helps to repair the structures and cells that carry our genetic information. And what the researchers were looking for was, could these chemicals, which are everyday items, but because they accumulate in our bodies, could they actually disrupt or cause mutations in our DNA? Now, the cells that they used were from female cancer cells, which were incubated with the two chemicals. And then the scientists checked for damage. Now, the chemicals did break down the protein, but it's important to note, if you have two normal copies of the gene, then it'll still be able to repair the structure even when coming into contact with the chemicals. And if you only have one copy of the gene, then they can't produce enough of the protein to repair the damage. And this could lead to cancer. So the research is interesting, but headlines such as shampoo, booze and car fumes, that was another one, lead to cancer. That is misleading. The research in this instance didn't prove that. What I think is people should try and reduce their exposure to chemicals as much as possible. But they are in our environment. It's difficult to reduce them absolutely.
And of course, we absorb so much through our skin, don't we?
That's a very important point, Simon, yeah.
Another headline that you may have seen, and this crops up every now and again, but it's antibacterial hand wash is no better than soap and cold water. Kills as many germs as hot experts claim.
This was a surprising headline. It was a US study, and the researchers wanted to check techniques, frequency, length of time for hand washing, and also what was used, soap or antimicrobial hand washes, as well as the temperature of the water. Though there are lots of hand washing information around there, there isn't much research to back up whether that information is correct. We've all got it up. For example, in my pharmacy, I think I've got 3 notices on this. 20 volunteers in the research study were used with an average age of 25, and they were infected with a particular strain of E. coli that doesn't cause infection. Clearly, they couldn't have used one that does. They then asked them to wash their hands and note the lather time, how much soap in volume, what was the water temperature, and whether they used ordinary soap or one containing an antimicrobial. The variables were changed then, and the experiment repeated 20 times. I'm just thinking of the poor participants' hands at this point.
You'd hope they'd be clean by then.
They weren't allowed to dry their hands either, so that the bacteria wouldn't be rubbed off when they were drying, and the hands were swabbed immediately after washing. The results were interesting, since using an antimicrobial soap isn't, in fact, or in this research, wasn't more effective at removing the bacteria. And the temperature of the water also didn't make a difference whether it was hot or cold. But washing for a greater length of time did reduce the bacteria. Now, this was a small study and only compared the soap containing a particular product, 1% chlorosilanol, and the antimicrobial soap and plain soap. So I don't think guidelines will be changed looking at this particular research. At the moment, the guidelines recommend washing with hot water and soap for at least 20 seconds. And that's after going to the toilet, after handling raw food, such as chicken and meat, and touching pets, cats and dogs. And I was thinking perhaps of guide dogs here. It is important about washing hands. That's what they recommend in the guidelines.
And I call me obsessive, but when I travel on public transport quite a lot, and that's one of the first things I ever do when I get wherever I'm going, or when I get home, is wash my hands.
Well, you know, I think of these, you know, the buttons thing we use for our pins. I wonder how often these machines are actually cleaned. That often occurs to me.
You've got these banisters on the electric escalators as well, and all these kind of things where, you know, you become overly.
Yeah, I think you can become obsessive, but I think it's just sensible. If you're going to be handling food and you've been elsewhere, then please wash your hands, yeah.
But I've ordered my bubble to live in. There you go. Because the thing is, I remember we got tested for this. I was doing some hospital radio.
Yeah.
So this was one of the things we had to be taught to make sure that you were clean. And they did the test where you washed and your hands the best you could, and then they put you under a UV light.
Interesting,
and showed you whether you had cleaned your hands properly.
Yeah.
And it was very important, the technique of cleaning your hands and taking the time to do that. And I don't think most of us, you know, we go get a bit of soap, out we go.
Yeah, we did the same thing in our pharmacy as an experiment. And one of my members of staff was absolutely brilliant. And we all watched how she did it. And it was very much about cleaning in between the digits and using that length of time to make sure everything was clean. And she was very, very good at it. And we learnt from that.
I passed as well. So you'll be glad to know. We've got another headline, actually. And this one particularly interests me. And it says that many patients given beta blockers after a heart attack may not benefit from being on the drugs. Now, first of all, tell us a bit about beta blockers.
Yeah, they're a class of drugs, Simon, that lower the beat of the heart. They actually have many uses, as well as heart problems. Angina, that's when you have chest pain with narrowing of the arteries. Heart failure, when your heart is not able to push forcefully enough to get the blood fully around the body. They're also used in AF, that's atrial fibrillation, that's when your heart beats irregularly, and also high blood pressure. Now, sometimes they could be used to prevent migraine or anxiety, tremor, overactive thyroid. So some of your listeners may be prescribed a beta blocker for their glaucoma, and that's obviously when they put it into the eye. And it's important to avoid systemic effects. Now, that's going into the body when you actually use an eye drop. And that's things like asthma or lowering of the heartbeat. So what I suggest when you use one of these, and I can give you an example of something like Timolol, which is a beta blocker for glaucoma, then hold the corner of your eye for maybe up to a minute after you put them in. And also closing the eyes for 2 to 3 minutes stops the medicine going down the back and possibly causing side effects. So the research was about beta blockers after heart attack, and you wanted to know about this, Simon.
Yes. Yeah, well, I actually was prescribed beta blockers, and I think it was to limit my heart to 125 beats a minute, I think.
Okay.
Now, I can still get up to 130, I know that for a fact. But I did ask the doctor at the specialist before I was given the all clear. Incidentally, I had heart attacks a few years ago after some treatments that I'd had. And he said, well, if you want to come off them, then, you know, go and see your GP, because I think probably you have to be weaned off them, I would imagine. But he said, no, they're doing the job, you're on good, so just carry on with them. But I've always wondered about that, so...
Yeah, okay. So the research really was about looking exactly the sort of question you're asking. And there were a lot of researchers collaborating in the study, English, Scottish, European institutions. It was funded by the British Heart Foundation, which I thought was very good. The researchers looked at patients given a beta blocker after a heart attack. And what they were looking at is whether that resulted in fewer deaths, because why would you take a beta blocker otherwise? The numbers were high, almost 180,000 people in the study. And they only looked at people who had had a heart attack, now not those with heart failure or some other form of heart dysfunction. just over 9,000 people died in the study within a year of the attack, and almost 95% of people received a beta blocker in the study. Now, the research showed that it didn't make a difference if people were given a beta blocker or not after a heart attack. And the present guidelines are that everyone should be given a beta blocker for 1 year. The results at the moment are not strong enough to change guidelines. For example, did everyone take their beta blockers after being prescribed them? That's a very important question. There were also a lot of people on many different medicines, and although this was taken into account, could that have made a difference in this study? Although the people with heart failure or a condition called left ventricular dysfunction were excluded from the study, they weren't followed up to find out if they developed the conditions within the year. Beta blockers don't tend to cause too many side effects, so taking them for a year will probably be acceptable to most people who've had a heart attack. Now, whatever happens, as you were saying, Simon, you can't stop a beta blocker suddenly. Definitely not, since this could cause palpitations, increased blood pressure, maybe even some angina pain. So any worries, please speak to your GP. But the results suggest there didn't seem to be much difference in those who took a beta blocker for 1 year after. And those are the guidelines presently. So please don't stop taking anything, and please ask about it if you're wanting to know more.
As always, Elizabeth, very thorough and detailed. Thank you very much. If you've got any questions on anything we've covered today, then please feel free to get in touch with me here. You can drop me a line or... drop me a line. How old am I? Drop me an email, get in touch some way. And if you'd rather talk to Elizabeth directly, then you can get in touch via her website, which is all the W's dot...
newlifepharmacy.co.uk.
And you have a phone number as well, don't you?
01416376000.
Elizabeth Roddick, always a pleasure to see you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon.